For many of us, the word cult automatically evokes images of charismatic megalomaniacs, coercion, unconventional sexual practices, groupthink, mass suicides, and loopy UFO worship. While much of that is true in some cases, trying to define what makes one group a cult and another a bunch of eccentrics isn't always easy. Still, for people who have been members of truly coercive cults, the experience can be extremely traumatic. For today's Please Explain look at cults, we are joined by Ian Howarth, who is with the UK-based Cult Information Center, and also Dr. Steve K.D. Eichel, a psychiatrist and president of the International Cultic Studies Association. I'm pleased to welcome both of them to our show. Hello.
Good afternoon.
And as always, we welcome our listeners' involvement in this. We invite your calls and questions at 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org or tweet us at our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Steve, how would you define a cult?
Well, it's important to realize that when we're talking about cults, we're talking about a broad range of groups, tremendous variation between those groups. And, of course, I'm using a terminology that is that can often be misleading because the classical definition of a cult is very different from the definition that that I'm employing or that we employ when we talk about cultic groups or destructive cults or what some folks call high demand groups. But essentially, most cults share a common set of characteristics, which include being led by a charismatic and authoritarian leader. They have a closed and steeply hierarchical inner structure. They adhere to an exclusive or total belief system. They engage in processes of systematic manipulation of social and psychological influence, which some in the press is often called brainwashing. Some researchers have called it coercive persuasion, but we're really talking about very intense methods of influence. And then finally, but certainly not exclusively, the followers are exploited. They're exploited either most often monetarily. They can be exploited sexually, of course, and many times they're exploited in terms of their labor, quote-unquote volunteer labor.
And we'll get into all of those things in more detail as we continue this conversation. Ian, is there anything you'd like to add to that?
Not really, other than to say that whilst we have five specific characteristics, the most important one for us is one that Steve touched on there, which is the use of psychological coercion, otherwise known as mind control or radicalization, in order to recruit, indoctrinate, and retain members.
There are all sorts of different kinds of cults, religious, doomsday, therapy cults, political cults. Do they, although they differ in aims, do they share similar tactics?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, most of the characteristics that Ann and I spoke of can be applied to all these groups. So you'll notice in the definitions that we're talking about, there's no mention of what that belief system would be. There's no mention of what kind of charismatic or authoritarian leader we're talking about. So probably the best example would be, or the best examples in history would be the Nazi Party, which it's most certainly started off as a political cult, as well as Stalinist communism, which again, Stalin was worshipped in the same way that many religious cult leaders have been worshipped.
Leading to the phrase, the cult of personality. We also saw that with Mao. Now,
absolutely,
Ian, Steve mentioned the thing that is often called brainwashing, that often comes up when cults are discussed. Is there such a thing as brainwashing?
Well, a lot of academics prefer to see brainwashing as a crude form of what Steve and I are probably talking about today. Brainwashing was first recognized when used against prisoners of war in Indochina and Korea. And there you knew you were dealing with the enemy, they were wearing enemy fatigues, and you were probably prevented from physically from leaving. But when we're talking about cults, we're talking about psychological methods that control someone without the use of being held physically. And so we do use different terms than brainwashing, and it's certainly a reality. And the average person, as far as we're concerned, can be broken down and controlled in a typical cult in a matter of 3 or 4 days.
Do they pretty much follow the same pattern?
We would suggest that there are 26 techniques of mind control, and all that changes from one cult to another is which particular combination of those techniques a particular group would use. And they do follow a pattern in as much as they only have those techniques to work with, and they will use them very effectively.
Steve, go ahead, Steve.
I'm sorry. A pattern that, and Ian's absolutely correct, a pattern that tends to be followed is to first isolate the victim, and that often is done physically, but it also can be done psychologically. In other words, there are certain groups that that don't involve indoctrination in a particular center and physically isolating people, but rather individuals will be sent home and told that what they've been through is confidential and private. Don't trust what other people tell you about it. Isolate yourself in your own room and study. So there are other forms of isolation that don't necessarily have to be physical, but isolation is usually the first step. Secondly,
wait, can I jump in here?
Please.
Because I spoke some years ago to a young former cult member, and I asked her, well, in your case, you weren't encouraged to leave your family, or she was still going to high school. I said, how did you reconcile what you were seeing in the everyday world with what was happening in the cult? And she said, well, we felt that we were in the hands of our leader. In this case, his name was John Rogers. We were in the equivalent of a boat on the water, and we were watching all those crazy people running around on the shore, not understanding the way the world really worked.
Excellent example. That's absolutely typical. So after isolating the recruit, the second method is to place limits on what they see, hear, or do. And again, that can be done physically. There are groups such as the Church of Scientology that do it by telling their members they have to use a proprietary search engine so that nothing critical of Scientology will be found if you search the internet. So there are various ways that that limits can be placed. And then finally, the person, the individuals doing the brainwashing, if you want to use that term, they raise uncertainty about the victim's or the recruit's old beliefs and habits. So the recruit is isolated from their past, and the past is often revised so that the individual who may have experimented with marijuana was actually engaging in a satanic or some other evil form of behavior that would inevitably lead to addiction. So your past gets reinterpreted. So those three steps are typically isolation, limiting information control, and then instilling fear and doubt about your past beliefs and past life. Those three steps seem to be true across the board in all cultic groups.
A listener has written in and described going to a meeting for a group which claimed that people who weren't in the group didn't have souls and were some kind of alien beings. I'm assuming there are also more subtle ways that that specialness in a group can be promoted.
Psychological cults will tell you, for example, that that you are in a vanguard of human psychological evolution, that your family is dysfunctional, that other people are dysfunctional. They'll use psychological language that that actually promote the same effect, which is isolating you from other individuals and also casting doubt where doubt may not have existed on your own past, your own previous beliefs and thoughts and feelings.
Now, Ian, is violence ever or threat of violence ever a component?
It can be, but it's not really necessary. For me, one of the common themes that we find over and over is a trance-inducing technique. I'm an ex-cult member myself, and in the group I was in, we were hypnotized 16 times in on a four-day course, we were told we were learning how to meditate, but the term meditation hadn't been defined. And it was, in fact, a countdown hypnotic procedure. And, of course, if someone's put into an altered state of consciousness, they're highly vulnerable to suggestion. So we're not talking here about people who are easily led. We're talking about people with healthy minds who are subjected to techniques that they're not aware of that break them down very, very quickly.
How did you get pulled into the cult?
I went on a course to quit smoking. That's all it appeared to be on the surface.
And then how did you get out? After you quit smoking, you didn't need it anymore?
A journalist managed to help me to leave. He was working in Canada for the Star newspaper, the Toronto Star, and he exposed the group as a group that had produced another psychiatric casualties, talked about others in the past, how it was a money-making concern, and so on, at a time when I hadn't been programmed against the media. This was in the early days of my involvement. And most cults will program you against the media, so you won't read articles like that or listen to an expose on the TV or radio or whatever. And so I was able to question for the first time what was going on, and I actually phoned the journalist, and he gave me a lot of time. He was a very kind gentleman. And he got me back to reality, but it took another year to fully recover, and that was an awful time. And this is, again, typical. If someone manages to escape from a cult, and many never do, if they do, then it normally takes at least a year to fully recover.
Later we'll talk about deprogramming, but I want to take some calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. People have been inspired by this conversation to call in. Betsy from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air. Betsy?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. When you were talking about the person you met who had gotten out of a cult, it made me think of my sister, who became a Moonie in 1970 when she was 17 years old. She still is one to this day. And she was from a very troubled family, was living on her own in Berkeley at 17, but she was seeing a psychiatrist through our family every day. And when she met the Moonies, and she decided to leave with them or join them, she told her psychiatrist, when he asked her what was better about them than him, and she said, "I found God." And no one could argue with that. So, you know, there are ways to catch people that are very vulnerable.
Steve?
Well, thank you for telling us your story, first of all, and you have my empathy for the fact that your sister is still involved, and of course now that's become basically her life. I think there are a number of things that I'd like to comment on. One being that certainly there are troubled people that become involved with cultic groups. However, there's been a very, very consistent body of research to show that the average person is actually the best target. That, in fact, the people who are most resistant to cultic influence are also the ones who are most resistant to any kind of social influence. So we're talking about, for example, hardened criminals. We're talking about individuals who are suffering from psychoses. But the average everyday person is at various points in their lives. They may not be as vulnerable, but at other points in their lives, they are very vulnerable. Psychologist Albert Bandura, back in 1983, was once asked, how do people become involved with cults? And he gave, in my opinion, the best response. He said it was bad luck. In other words, basically, you're in a vulnerable state in a period of transition, such as being 17 years old and being on your own in Berkeley, which, you know, millions of people experience. Everyone experiences various stages of transition. Or perhaps you're a little bit depressed because your boyfriend or girlfriend broke up with you, or you lost your job. And most of us, of course, during those periods in our lives, we don't encounter a cult recruiter, so therefore we don't become involved with a cult. But if in fact you have the bad luck to either encounter a cult recruiter or, in some cases, search out somebody who will quickly provide an answer, those are the individuals who then become vulnerable to cultic influence. So it's not so much a psychological
or personality characteristic that makes one vulnerable to a cult, but rather a particularly vulnerable stage in their life, which almost everyone goes through at one point or another.
I have to go to a break, but Betsy, did your sister get married within
that was the... what I was just going to add. Yes, she got married.
So that keeps her in the cult.
5,500 people at Madison Square Garden in 1983. I went, and I have photographs of it. But her husband, just listening to this right now, her husband was a very straight, normal guy from outer Brooklyn, you know, regular family. And I've always wondered how he got brought into the cult, because he wasn't anything like her, and they're still married and have six children.
Wow.
But Betsy, I would say that it's straight, normal people that are recruited. These techniques work on captains of industry. They work on high-achieving people. It's just a matter of walking through the wrong door and not knowing what mind control is, and you'll become a victim. You don't have to be going through a period of transition, but I agree with Steve that if you are, you might be easier to approach than otherwise. But if you walk through the wrong door, like I did, and like the thousands of people I've talked to over the years, then these techniques will work unless you recognize them.
We have to take a little break. My guests on today's Please Explain are Ian Howarth of the UK-based Cult Information Center and Dr. Steve K.D. Eichel, psychiatrist and president of the International Cultic Studies Association. When we come back, we'll be taking more of your calls, and we'll be talking about some of the other issues that we have been discussing here about recruitment, about the difference between a cult and a religion, about whether about the cult leaders and how they continue to control people. I once interviewed a woman who had been a member of the People's Temple, Jim Jones's Jonestown cult. She had been left behind. Even after all that stuff happened, she remained a believer. How that happens, we'll continue after this. We're back with today's Please Explain look at cults. Ian Howarth of the UK-based Cult Information Center, Dr. Steve K.D. Eichel, who's a psychologist and president of the International Cultic Studies Association. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate. You were talking earlier about the ways that people are recruited. A listener, Tomas in Brooklyn, wrote into our show page to say that he was once approached on a subway platform by an attractive man who acted as if they had met before. And he writes, I was making small talk with this guy trying to figure out where or if we had met, and suddenly he asked me if I'd ever thought about my future or questioned the meaning of my life. When I asked, what do you mean? And he pulled out a New Age-looking book, I said, I want to share the teachings of so-and-so with you. I kind of knew what was going on. Now, does that work with a lot of people?
Well, it can do. It's just about every employ imaginable out there that cults will employ. I used to, when I was trying to recruit people in the brief time I was in the group, I used to do fake surveys on street corners just to get to talk to people. It could be your medical doctor who recommends cult X to you because he or she is a member. It could be a teacher at school, unfortunately. It could be absolutely anybody that you interact with in life.
Well, how did you deal with their doubts?
How
did you deal with their doubts? Because I'm sure that at the beginning they express doubts. It's only later that you're able to quell all the doubts.
In my own case, I was doing a survey simply asking people questions that they're bound to say yes to. In other words, could the world be a better place? Do you think education could be improved? Do you think this and that and the other? I can't remember the exact questions. And it was yes, 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 yes. And then I would tell them that and I was doing what was instructed, I would tell them that the way they answer these questions, they'd be really interested in this community group that was putting back into society instead of taking all the time like people do. It was helping to make the world a better place. And if they asked questions, I would just waffle and try and get them to that first meeting, and it wasn't difficult at all.
A caller... Go ahead, Steve.
A good cult recruiter is going to use basically the same tactics that a good salesperson will use. And so, yep. For example, Ian is describing a well-known sales tactic, which is called establishing the yes set. The foot in the door technique is very commonly used. So, for example, if you have questions, well, those are great questions. We want to answer those questions. The best thing for you to do is to come to a meeting, and that's where you'll get your questions answered. And then, of course, at that meeting, the questions aren't answered, but you have to go to the next meeting, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, some people aren't going to, just as a good salesperson doesn't sell their condominiums to everyone, but he sells or she sells them to enough people. And a good cult recruiter actually is going to be savvy enough to know who's not amenable to the sales pitch, because that's a waste of time to spend trying to recruit that individual. You're going to move on to the next person.
Are there certain cultic elements to things we encounter in our day-to-day lives? Are certain kinds of corporate life or even some community organizations cultic?
Absolutely. When we talk about cultic influence, we're really talking about influence, period. And influence is all around. I mean, I'm a psychologist. I get paid to influence people, hopefully. Influence is a normal, everyday process that we all experience. The difference being that, number one, cultic groups employ systematic and manipulative forms of influence, largely, as Ian indicated with his answer, the surveys that he was conducting, there's an element of deceit. There's a hidden agenda involved. When I go to a car salesman, I expect to get a sales pitch for a car. I don't expect to get a religious pitch. So even with salespeople, typically these days, most salespeople are pretty above board. They're not going to try to trick you. They don't engage in overt deceit, at least, because they know that's usually counterproductive. But cultic groups will very typically engage in some form of deceit, especially in the beginning, because, again, the cultic mentality is that the ends justify the means. If I'm trying to save your soul or save the world, what difference does it make if I tell you a little white lie, quote-unquote?
A caller who didn't want to be identified was in Scientology for 28 years and said many people got involved because they became addicted to the therapeutic feeling of Dianetics. Now... Mm. Now, we're talking about Scientology, which covers many different fronts, because it also is a religion in this country, although it has been declared a cult in some countries. I think Germany has it listed as a cult. But there is a certain kind of, this person suggests, an addictive aspect to the membership.
I believe in Germany, Scientology, at least in some states, is listed as a fraudulent business activity. Which is, in my opinion, just as accurate. I'm sorry, could you repeat your question?
Well, I was just wondering about the addictive aspect that person was talking about.
Well, Ian touched on that nicely when he talked about trance, because there is sort of an addictive quality to going into an altered state of consciousness, number one. And number two, typically what happens in a cultic group is you come in with, perhaps you might come in with one or two problems, and lo and behold, after being indoctrinated for a while, you discover that you have many, many problems. If you're a Mooney, the problems go back generations, because you're dealing with your ancestors all the way back to Adam and Eve. So basically what cultic groups do is induce, and not all groups, but many groups at least, will induce the anxiety, induce problems that you didn't even know that you had, quote-unquote, and then, of course, they offer the solution. So there's an addictive quality to that, just as if you become addicted to heroin, initially you don't crave heroin, right? Initially you just get high, but then after a while you begin to crave it, and heroin no longer is being used to get high, but actually to avoid the pain. So in a cultic group, when you begin to, if you do begin to pull away mentally or psychologically or spiritually, you begin to feel guilt and anxiety that you never had before.
And, of course, the cure for that guilt and anxiety is another hit of the cult group, so to speak.
Let's take some calls. Anne from North Bergen, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to ask your guests what the founders of cults, what characteristics do these people have in common? And what do the organizations have in common as self-reinforcing structures?
Ian?
Well, we talked, I think Leonard mentioned the aims of groups, and perhaps we can look at the aims of leaders and look at what they have in common. I would suggest that the common denominators, if I put it that way, are money and people coming into these groups, which, of course, gives leaders wealth and power and influence. And those are very attractive things for a lot of people, not just cult leaders.
But I would say, I wouldn't imagine that somebody just wakes up one day and says, I'm going to found a cult. Isn't this something that kind of develops? They may even start off, as we saw with Synanon,
yep,
or some other groups,
yep,
as a good intention group, and then, or a group that had a certain political viewpoint or a certain,
yep,
rereading of the Bible or whatever, and then little,
yep,
by little they become something else?
Absolutely. And I'm suggesting here that once it's in operation, those are the common denominators. But what causes a cult to be started in the first place could well be a leader who started off A-OK. Everything was kosher, and then he went off on a tangent. So the power of love turns to the love of power. There are some cult leaders, though, who would probably be seen as quite seriously mentally ill, who actually do believe that they are God or whatever they're claiming to be.
That's a very important statement, and I want to emphasize that there are a lot of different kinds of leaders. And, of course, some do. For example, L. Ron Hubbard famously said that the way to make money is to start your own religion, and then he went ahead and did it. So there are a few cult leaders who probably do wake up one day, in a sense, and say, you know, I should start a maybe not a cult, but I should start a group. But I think what Ian pointed to is really important as well. I think there are a lot of people who begin with a vision or an insight, and they develop a following, and then that following begins to worship them in a way which then actually sets off a almost like a cascade effect of narcissism. And so the cult leader may have started off with maybe the average or slightly above average amount of narcissism that we all have, but then by virtue of perhaps the insight or the charisma or the vision that person has, they develop a cadre, an inner core of very intense followers who begin to tell him or her, usually him, that, yeah, you are infallible. Yes, you are very special. Yes, you are perhaps even a divine being sent here by God, or perhaps you are even God.
Don't they often put their followers through certain tests to make sure that they will be true believers? Like Esalen, the leaders, insisted that all the men have vasectomies. In other cults, there's an awful lot of sexual activity. But in either case, it's asking people to go beyond where they normally would go.
Most cultic groups,
I would suggest that,
yeah,
that would normally happen after someone's already become a victim of mind control. Once the leader controls you, if he wants you to have a vasectomy, you do. If he wants you to do this, you do it. And
if you don't have the vasectomy, then you're not to be trusted and you're out of the cult.
Well, if you're not going to follow orders, you're not under control. And so you're automatically either going to be worked on to control you or thrown out, yes.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely the case.
Well, to the point where some people actually have suicide cults. There's a difference between the Heaven's Gate cult and other UFO cults like the Raelians or Jonestown. Is the suicide often because of an apocalyptic vision or because the cult suddenly feels threatened from the outside?
I think that you may have hit on it when you say the cult leader may feel threatened from the outside. I think that would be a good way to explain what happened with Jim Jones and the People's Temple, tragically, in November of 1978. which was a month after I'd escaped from the group I was in. So you can imagine how that impacted on me. I felt so sorry for those people and realized I could have been one of them. I wasn't in that group, but I related to what was going on right away. And so it could be a perceived threat. Someone has sussed what I'm up to, and so I better do something about it and take everybody with me. But really, I don't see any need to describe a group as one that's suicidally oriented. It's just that the control in a cult is such that any leader at any point in time could do that with the membership. But of course, that would stop the money coming in, it would stop the people coming in, and of course, these leaders tend to die with the group as well. And so there would be no more of that power that the leader may enjoy or the money. And so most cults are not going to end in such a dramatic fashion, but I would say that the potential is there in all cults.
Spencer from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello.
Go ahead, Spencer.
So I was, first of all, I'd like to say that both of the gentlemen speaking have described to a T what I found in my experience. And I just wanted to make the point that maybe hasn't been emphasized enough, is that at least in New York City, and I think in other major urban areas, these cults are everywhere. I don't think people realize just how ubiquitous they are. I'm what I consider myself a survivor. I actually got myself kicked out for giving them too many problems. I was one of the guys that wouldn't take orders, but it managed to suck up about 7 years of my life, almost destroyed my marriage. And, I consider myself in a certain way lucky to get out, but the own attributes that I have of being a somewhat difficult person actually finally saved me. In the sense that I knew something was wrong. I was determined to figure out what it was that everybody seemed to be so enamored of. And finally, I think they realized that I was never going to toe the line.
Are you? Can you be more specific? Are you not willing to tell us the cult that you were a member of?
Sure. I mean, it calls itself, they call themselves The Work. And they won't give the name out even that much, The Work, until you've been involved for quite a long time. So they're very savvy about not letting out their name. At the time, back in the 90s, there was no information on the Internet about these cults. I did search and couldn't find anything and assumed, this must be a real thing, a very special thing that's not privy to the general public.
Thank you for calling us. I've also spoken to people who've said that they went from one cult to another. They would leave a cult, and then because they were they were vulnerable, they joined another cult. It's often argued that religions start off as cults. Is that fair?
Well, can I just address that issue, Leonard? Some people call what you've just described about going from one cult to another, they call it cult hopping. I don't like the term at all. And it suggests the person is choosing to do that, and I don't believe choice is involved when you become involved in a cult. Choice is removed. But if someone comes out of a cult and they don't get help, they don't see Steve, they don't see somebody in our field who can help them back to reality and understand what's gone on, then it can happen again and again and again.
And in the past, there were these deprogrammers who would be hired by parents who wanted their children out of the cult, and they would be put into coercive situations that sounded to me to be as awful as the cult.
Deprogramming was always controversial. It had to be, because families and deprogrammers were taking the law into their own hands. But it only accounted for a tiny, tiny percentage, probably way less than 5% of all the cases where a third party would help someone to exit from a group. And so the term today is exit counseling for what's a voluntary situation. And anyone that's been exit counseled by a skilled exit counselor from a cult is less likely to be recruited in the future if they've had help in the recovery afterwards and know what to watch out for.
Now, we have very little time. Steve, can you deal with that other question? Hasn't it been argued that a number of religions began as cults?
Well, again, that
we're using a single term to describe a very broad range of activities. So it is true, using the term cult from a sociological point of view, it is true that many, but not all, religions have started out as small groups with a charismatic leader, et cetera, et cetera. However, there are certain characteristics that really do make the difference, and of course, one of them being exploitation of members. So many religions, when they started out, they may have isolated, engaged in some of the influence techniques that we've discussed here, and they probably had a charismatic leader. However, typically, the members were not exploited financially, psychologically, or sexually, and typically they didn't engage in a systematic control of information.
One other thing before you go, if somebody is in a cult or is a family member of somebody in a cult, how do they wind up making the process, the transition out? Do they have to call somebody? A cult member is unlikely to call somebody and say, "I want out."
Right. Actually, some do. Most people walk out on their own. Most people become disillusioned. If they get deeply involved in the group, they may see things that, you know, for example, a cultic group that, and many cults, the control of sexuality is very common in cultic groups. So they may be in a group that says no, sex is wrong, it's bad, it's sinful, and then they get so involved in the group that they find out that the leader is in fact sexually exploiting people, and that causes a great cognitive dissonance, and as a result they leave the group. So most people actually do walk away. As Ian indicated, there is a significant number of those people who leave, typically and often feeling guilty, feeling like there's something that they did wrong. And those individuals may, in fact, be more vulnerable to being recruited in another group. In addition, of course, they don't understand how they got recruited to begin with, so that leaves them vulnerable as well. But a small number, a significant but small number of individuals leave because of an intervention from a loved one or a good friend. Some leave. The Internet has been instrumental in that way, because some people actually do, let's say in a moment of doubt, you know, begin searching information, and they find information that greatly contradicts what they've learned in the group. And other people are counseled out by encountering, sometimes seeking them out themselves, but probably more often through the advice of a good friend or a family member who they are still in contact with.
Dr. Steve K.D. Eichel is a psychologist and president of the International Cultic Studies Association. Ian Haworth is with the UK-based Cult Information Center. Thank you both so much for being on today's Please Explain.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Leonard.